Welcome to this Forthright Radio for January 18th, 2017. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. Returning to Forthright Radio to be with us for the full hour is veteran CIA officer turned political activist Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern was a CIA analyst for 27 years, from 1963 to 1990, where he chaired national intelligence estimates and prepared the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Reagan's five most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. He received the Intelligence Commendation Medal at his retirement, but he returned it, that is the medal, in 2006 to protest the CIA's involvement in torture. In 2003, he co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We'll get into more activities of his activities during our interview. But for now, Ray McGovern, we welcome you once again to Forthright Radio.
Thank you very much.
Oh, we are so happy to have you here. We have so much to talk about with you, Ray. Well, first of all, the news about Chelsea Manning. You lead a section of Tell the Word, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of Savior, which is in inner city Washington, D.C., that's called Speaking Truth to Power. And one of the courses you've been teaching is on the morality of whistleblowing. Very briefly, tell us about that course and your comments on Chelsea Manning's sentence being commuted.
Well, thank you very much. I welcome the opportunity to explain why we support Chelsea Manning. You know, when this first broke, there was a lot of I would say controversy among us, former intelligence officers and national security specialists, as to whether Chelsea Manning had done the correct thing. And we hashed it out. We looked at what she had, or he at the time, had released, and we found out that, my goodness, these show, well, let's be quite frank about it, war crimes perpetrated by our forces in Iraq. They show the deliberate killing of 12 people there on that one day in July during the so-called surge in Iraq, including two Reuters correspondents. And then we saw the shooting up of a van, which had two young children in it, killing everyone but the two children. So, you know, we asked ourselves, well, now, when you see those kinds of things, are you bound not to reveal it because it's classified? And the way we pieced through this was simply this way. These things are classified to protect national security. You sign a piece of paper as a condition of employment in which you say you will not release information at the confidential, secret, or top secret level that might endanger national security. Now, is that an oath? No way. That's a little contract. That's something you sign as a condition of employment. Is it a promise? Yeah, it's a promise. Are promises important? Of course promises are important. But they're not important, not as important as oaths. And the only oath that we swear as intelligence officers, or in my case it was an Army officer to begin with, is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, that's the controlling factor here, and what ethicists or moral theologians, the way they label this is a supervening value, supervening, which means that the value of an oath, particularly on matters of such consequences as act of war, supersede or supervene lesser contracts, lesser promises, and in this case, not only Manning, but of course Edward Snowden were, in our view, acting with the highest morality in seeing that their duty was to honor their oath to defend the Constitution and not be bound, as so many of us have been, to say, oh, I can't tell the American people that we're committing war crimes in Iraq because it's a secret. So to have that kind of courage is laudatory, and that's why we awarded Chelsea Manning the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence. Now, did all of us agree? No. No way. We have some very, very, very principled people, but people who just couldn't see that the overwhelming reality here was the American people needed to know the truth, and so those people who couldn't see that, well, we lost two or three of our movement, but we could see it pretty clearly. And I think when you look at the materials that were divulged, the one thing that I would say is that it is a canard to say that what Chelsea Manning released harmed U.S. people in a physical kind of way or put them in jeopardy. Now, this is what they said immediately. I remember Robert Gates, who fellow who used to work for me when he was a young analyst at CIA, he became Secretary of Defense. And as soon as Chelsea Manning released these emails or these photos or these videos, he said, my God, this is going to cause awful damage to our forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Carl Levin, who is head of the Armed Services Committee in the Senate, he said, wow, okay, well, Mr. Secretary Gates, please give us a memo on that. And, you know, four or five weeks later, Gates sent a memo, and it said, and this is a virtual quote, contrary to our worst fears, there has been no reporting of anyone being harmed by the revelations in these emails. Now, in reality, no one was so much as spat upon in reaction to this. What people learned was what the young folks, and this is not a volunteer army we have, this is a poverty draft. These are people who have no options in the small towns of our country or in the inner city, no options other than going in the army. They get conditioned such a way that they really don't care very much where they're strafing or where their machine gunning is going. So what I'm saying here is that the overwhelming value here was to tell the truth. The only possible explanation as to why this shouldn't have been done was, were it to harm our forces in the area. And Gates finally said, no one was harmed, and, wonderful phrase, the reports that people were harmed are, quote, significantly overwrought, period, end quote. Now, Gates has a way with words. He saw no embarrassment in having claimed the opposite a month before. But now he said, no, there's no evidence that people were so much as spat upon, not his words, but that the charges were, quote, significantly overwrought, end quote. Well, no one held him accountable. The Central Command said the same thing. They didn't say significantly overwrought, but they said, no, there's no reporting of any damage. So when you get all these guys on CNN, and all these former generals who don't even reveal that they're getting paid the megabucks for working on Lockheed's board of directors and that kind of thing, when you get them saying, oh, it's awful, terrible stuff, when you get Paul Ryan, the guy from Wisconsin who heads up the representatives of the Republicans there, saying, oh, this is awful, this is terrible, he's a traitor and all that stuff, either they don't know what they're talking about, either they're being brainwashed by people in the media who want to make this case, or they're being, well, let me put it this way, or they're giving hypocrisy a bad name.
Oh, I see. Well, also having his sentence commuted was General Cartwright, who Jeremy Scahill describes on Democracy Now! Today, that he leaked to the New York Times, and that he was part of what Jeremy Scahill calls, quote, the official leaks program, end of quote, of the White House, but then lied to the FBI about it. So it was less the leak than more the lie. Do you have any comments on his commutation?
Well, it used to be ipso facto a felony to lie to the FBI. Petraeus did it. It's no secret. That's public information. Petraeus was a four-star general. People probably remember that in order to ingratiate himself with this lovely lady, he gave her several notebooks full of the highest classified information, to include information on CIA staffers and CIA sources. Now, when he was asked, did he do that by the FBI? He said, no, he denied it. Okay. Now, what happened to him? Well, they tried him, not in the Federal District of Alexandria, where they have hanging juries all the time. No, they tried him down in North Carolina, where they have several military bases and much more benign juries, okay? What did he get? He got a slap on the wrist. He was charged with a misdemeanor. He was required to do no jail time. And they fined him, if I recall correctly, $100,000, which is about two-thirds of what Petraeus gets for one one-hour speech. Okay? Now, was that proportionate to what they charged Chelsea Manning or Ed Snowden? Not at all. Was it proportionate to the other leakers, seven or eight or nine, that have been charged in federal court by the Obama administration? Of course not. So when I heard yesterday that Cartwright had been freed and he's not going to have to face those charges, I yawned and I said, so what's new? There are double standards here. People who leak this information, even if they lie about it to the FBI, well, it doesn't turn out to be a felony anymore. Or if it's a felony, as in this case, this is different in the sense that the FBI said, look, if you're going to let people lie to us, and let Petraeus off with no jail time and a $100,000 fine, oh, now I forgot, he got 6 months probation anyway, as well. If you're going to let people like that off, well, we might as well just, join the local police force. We're supposed to have the power to make people tell the truth. And if they lie to us, that's supposed to be a felony. It always has been. So I think that the professionals in the FBI said, look, we don't care who might have told Cartwright to do what he did or whether he did it on his own. He did it. And then he lied about it. And so we're not going to hang around here and say, oh, that's okay. We'll give him a fine and some probation. We want him tried. Okay? Now, that's the kind of situation that no president or no attorney general wants to face. This is very, very embarrassing. And when you talk about leaks, let me try to explain how I look at this. The FBI is not above leaking, right? The FBI has leaked lots of stuff over the last couple of years. These agents who have been outraged at preferred treatment given one felon over another. And so there is a function for leaks, which I would characterize as potential preemptive leaks, okay? Or actually, you say preemptive potential leaks. What do I mean? I mean that Obama and the Attorney General and the head of the FBI look at these professionals, note how outraged they are, and know that they're going to leak, okay? So there's the potential leak. They're going to leak. And so what does the FBI director do? Well, they find ways to prevent or preempt these potential leaks by taking other measures, by making sure that there is some sort of trial. And, of course, this obtained in spades with respect to Hillary Clinton's email thing where James Comey had the book on her and needed to do the investigation, came out in the first instance saying, yeah, she did something really, really stupid or bad, but we're not going to pursue her case. So what I'm saying here is that the professionals, and I know there are some in the CIA as well still, feel strongly about lying, especially people who lie under oath. And that's, I think, why Cartwright, who lied to the FBI, that's the equivalent of lying under oath, why he was pursued to this point. Now, he's off the hook. Now, why is that? Well, they don't want FBI professionals leaking. The other thing has to do with the content, with the subject of his leaking. It had to do with Stuxnet. Now, Stuxnet is a very, very interesting operation. Here's what happened. And there's a film about this now. Alex Gibney, Zero something. Anyhow, he's put out a film, and it's available. And what does the film show? And it shows the real situation. Well, the Israelis came to us and said, we think the Iranians are about to get a nuclear weapon. We have information that they're very close, and so we're going to attack them. And our White House said, oh, wait a second, no, you can't do that, because our relationship with Israel is such that, politically speaking, the White House would be in that war from the beginning to, quote, defend, end quote, Israel. Now, that was 2009, okay? So Obama is president. Now, we talked to the Israelis, and the Israelis says, yeah, we're going to do that. We've got to preempt this thing because they're very close. And we said to the Israelis, well, wait a second. Our intelligence community concluded in November of 2007, so 2 years before all this is going down, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Nuclear program, of course, for electricity, but a nuclear weapon, they stopped in 2003. So Israelis, please relax. That was a unanimous decision of all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies expressed with high confidence. Relax. We can tell you if they're working on a nuclear weapon again. The Israelis said, no, we don't agree. We're going to attack them. Now, instead, and this speaks volumes for how Obama looks at these things. Instead of Obama saying, you are in the pig's neck, you go attack Iran, you're on your own. Instead of that, he said, oh, gosh, how do we prevent the Israelis from attacking Iran and getting us involved even deeper in the Middle East? Now, there's a lot of money floating around in the CIA with people who are involved in covert action. They don't have a lot to do, and they're pretty imaginative. And some of them said, hey, I know what we could do. We could create a computer virus that we could introduce into the centrifuges that are the sine qua non for enrichment program, and we could destroy them. We can do that. And, of course, we'd need the Israelis to help us because they're just as good, if not better, in developing these kinds of these computer viruses. That's what happened. It's right in the film. You have to right in the Alex Gibney film that's just out. What happened was they said, oh, this is what we do.
Excuse me.
Oh, pardon?
Is that film Every Move You Make?
Say again?
Ray, is the name of that film you're talking about every move you make?
No, it's the word zero is in it. I forget the other word, but it's just out. And
Zero days.
Right. I was talking with Gibney about it just a week ago up in New York. And I watched it. It's really quite fascinating. So let me just finish up on this. What it shows is that the Israelis and we, despite the fact that our intelligence community continued every year to reassure the president that the Iranians indeed had stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003, unanimous, expressed with high confidence, despite all that, because the Israelis said they're going to attack Iran. Anyway, we introduced this Stuxnet virus. Now, what did it do? It blew up these centrifuges. So this is not something that, you know, interfered with the workings of a computer. It destroyed centrifuges, hundreds of them. Not only that, but coincident with that, there were attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists. I say attacks. There were murders of about five of them. Now, that's what the movie shows, and that's the Stuxnet virus. And what's the importance there? Well, a whole new realm of warfare was introduced here, cyber warfare. It showed itself to be possible. It showed itself to be physically destructive if devised in very imaginative ways. And it was then the Russians came forward and said, you know, this is really dangerous. We really ought to have a treaty or something, you know, just like we did on nuclear weapons or testing things in space. And we can talk about it, but this is really, really bad stuff. And we have deflected all attempts by the Russians and others to discuss this issue. So getting back to Cartwright, that's what he's talking about. He was talking about Stuxnet. And there could be no more, sensitive information at the time he released it than the information that we now know has to do with the Israelis persuading us, despite our intelligence is persuading us that the Iranian facilities have to be not interfered with by a virus, but destroyed.
We're speaking with Ray McGovern, a 27-year veteran of the CIA, being an officer and one of the co-founders of Veteran Professionals Intelligence, tell me what it is, Ray.
Sure, it's a little mouthful, but it's Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
Sanity,
and,
got it.
One reason we chose that cumbersome label was it makes us VIPs, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
got
most
it.
Of us,
well,
some of us, some of us reach the rank of.
Let me just continue with.
Some of us reach the rank.
My introduction about this next comment. You speak fluent Russian. During the Vietnam War, as one of your roles as an officer at the CIA, you were responsible for analysis of Soviet policy. Now, Russia has been in the news, and it's kind of ironic because the part of the hubbub was that they interfered in cyber warfare with the U.S. election, and the allegation is that they have control of Trump because they've got the goods on him in terms of embarrassing information. I'm sure you must have thoughts on this. Could you please share them with us?
Yes, well, as a matter of fact, VIPs, and it was more than just a matter of making ourselves VIPs, although that is explained precisely by the fact that we insisted so much on always telling the truth that we never made it to, well, most of us didn't make it to the equivalent of general, the status of a one-star, two-star, three-star general. We were never at the very supreme top of our intelligence agencies, This way we could make ourselves ipso facto VIPs, okay? The other thing was the sanity part, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. Well, we were doing sanity checks with each other even before we formed ourselves officially in January of 2003. We saw that our president and vice president were lying through their teeth. And before you give a story or an op-ed to the Baltimore Sun or the Charlotte Observer or the San Francisco Examiner saying that, you like to check with people you trust. And so you send it to Jim and say, Jim, you know, I think this is going on. Can you give me a sanity check here? And that's what we did. So when we formed ourselves, it was a natural thing to include sanity in that because, number one, we have been giving each other sanity checks for a whole year during 2002. And number two, there wasn't an awful lot of sanity going around in Washington at the time, nor is there now. So what did we do? Yesterday, we published a memorandum, 23 of us signed, and it had to do with all these charges that without Mr. Putin, quote, intervening, end quote, in our election, Donald Trump would not have won. Now, that's a very serious charge. That not only encumbers the incoming president with charges that he never would be there without the support of the hated Russians, but that he is somehow in their pocket. Now, how do we explain all that? Well, it's necessary to go back to people probably remember August, September, or even July of last year. Mrs. Clinton was way ahead in the polls, and every time Donald Trump opened his mouth, she got a little higher in the polls, right? And the Democratic National Convention was coming, and lo and behold, what happens? 2 days before the convention, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange in London, release a bevy of emails that's easily searchable and that shows, what does it show? It shows that Hillary Clinton stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders. I mean, it's right there in the content of these emails. Emails having to do with the Democratic National Committee. So what happened? Now, bear in mind, this is 2 days before. Well, the first thing that happened was that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the Democratic National Committee and a big close associate of Hillary's, quit. And so did the next four people under her. So the top five people quit from the Democratic National Committee 2 days before the convention. Does that tell you something? Well, that didn't really get much print or much exposure in the TV media. Now, then, of course, we had Hillary in the situation of having to deal with these emails. How could they, how could they possibly handle this? And I wasn't there, of course. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall, but here they are sitting around in their sort of war room, and saying, my God, this is awful. This is, what are we going to do? And one of them said, well, I know what we can do. We blame the Russians. And I could see the looks on the others. Well, yeah, but it wasn't the Russians. It was WikiLeaks. That's okay. That's okay. We'll say that the Russians gave them to WikiLeaks. That would be a twofer. We'll get two hated entities at the same time, the Russians and Julian Assange. And then people started to come around and say, wow. And somebody said, yeah, but what would be the rationale? And somebody said, well, come on. The rationale, of course, is that the Russians want to defeat Hillary. They want Trump to win. That'll sell. And you know what? That did sell. That sold big time. The major media went with that story, and lost in the shuffle was the content of these emails, which showed that Hillary Clinton cheated Bernie Sanders out of the Democratic nomination. It was the most magnificent distraction that I've ever seen in this town, and I've seen a lot in 50 years, okay? So that's where it started. That's where the Russians started to be blamed for these things. And if you take it down to the present day, you have a situation where, oops, Hillary didn't win. My God. Now, I have a lot of Democratic as well as Republican friends. Both of them are still in shock. The Republicans sort of getting used to this very unconventional candidate and president-elect now. But my Democratic friends just have not been able to make their peace with what happened. I've been describing this as PTSD. They have this disease because it was totally unexpected. It was a battle, you know. It was a very real battle, this election. And they have post-traumatic PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. That accounts for why so many are saying, hey, it can't be legitimate. It must have been the Russians. It must have been anything but the fact that the U.S. electorate voted for him in the way they did. And so you have people, you know, to my great, great dismay, people like the civil rights icons saying that Trump is illegitimate. 50 or so Democratic members of Congress have decided to boycott the inauguration, all on the assumption that he is illegitimate and that it was the Russians that tipped the scales so that he could win. Now, that lets Hillary advocates off the hook. I mean, it couldn't possibly be that they nominated a flawed candidate that just wouldn't quit, that nobody trusted, that as bizarre a candidate as Donald Trump was, as outrageous as some of the things that he said, he played a very clever game and won the Electoral College. That's what governs who becomes president. So no one could, my Democratic friends, they can't believe that Hillary and her very, very smart, they're really smart folks, politicians, that they blow it, that they didn't campaign in the right states. Now, even though the President of the United States said that Russian hacking had nothing to do with the election results in a mechanical sort of way, the machines or the computers, they were not hacked. The results were what they have been seen to be. Even though the President said that, the artificial conflation of the win by Trump and the shock and the fact that Trump had said some decent things about the devil incarnate. Now, if you look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, just today, major editorials, Putin is the devil incarnate. And if you talk about whether NATO is obsolete, well, you're just a shade above being one of the devil's closest associates. So this is just by way of saying that there were a lot of reasons why they had to find some other way to explain why Hillary lost. And the last thing I'll say is that in trying to encumber the incoming president by saying that he's a tool or a puppet of Putin, they make it much harder for him to implement a more sensible policy in talking to the Russians, making deals with the Russians, the way we used to do when I was on active duty, so to speak. I was in Moscow in 1972 when Nixon came to sign the Strategic Arms Limitations Treaties, the first ones. We could talk to the Russians. Nixon asked us, now look, if we do this deal, can you verify that the Russians are complying? And, you know, it's the old trust, but verify. It didn't start with Reagan. It started with Nixon. Nobody knows that. And we said, well, show us the deal. And Kissinger and Nixon showed us the deal. We said, yes, sir, we can verify that the Russians are cheating if they cheat. And the next question was, well, how soon? I mean, we can't wait a year. And we went back to the drawing board and we said, we can tell you in 2 weeks. We have that kind of coverage of the Soviet Union. We can tell you in 2 weeks. And that enabled the strategic arms limitation talks and the treaty, the ABM treaty, the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which was an incredible factor for mutual stability during those years, and which was which George W. Bush exited from that treaty as soon as he came into power. So what I'm saying here is that you can deal with the Russians. Do you have to be appropriately suspicious? Of course you do. Do you have to ask your intelligence people whether they can verify this kind of agreement? Of course you do, but you can deal with them. So lastly, in talking about dealing with people who have been represented on the, you know, on the covers of Time and Newsweek and everywhere else as the devil incarnate, Putin sometimes wear no shirt. Putin sometimes ride horse with no shirt on. Putin very bad. Putin invade Ukraine. Putin bad. It's really ridiculous, the propaganda stuff. Okay, so what I'm saying is this, that to the degree that you can associate Trump with Putin, well, how is Trump going to start talking with Putin? Now, if he's his own man, and I suspect he is, he's going to do it anyway. But every day you're going to see in the mainstream press, so-called, a title saying, Trump giving the store away, Trump talking with the hated Russians. And, you know, if you look just eight short years ago, Obama said, well, when he was campaigning, that, you know, it makes sense to talk to people. One of the first things I'm going to do if I win, is talk to the Iranians. Whoa, now the Iranians, they were just short of the devil incarnate, right? And Hillary and everyone else said, oh, I would never talk to the Iranians. No. Well, he did talk to the Iranians. It took him a while. You know, it took him a whole year before he authorized talks with the Iranians. But you know what came out of that? A hard slog of negotiations, not only between the U.S. and Iran, but the other Security Council members and West Germany. And we have a deal now, a verifiable deal, which prevents Iran from obtaining anything near a nuclear missile capability for about 10 years. So it pays to talk to these people, even though the propagandists in this country make them out to be the devil incarnate or something slightly less.
Well, we reported in the fall when we were doing a story on Project Censored 2017, they have a very important section in that edition talking about the role of the CIA using the media, not just around the world, but in the United States to influence, shall we say. What can you say about that?
Well, first and foremost, it's illegal. When the CIA was set up, its entire mission looked abroad, not in these United States. That's not to say we couldn't interview travelers that were in China or in Russia. That's okay. You can do that in the United States. But you don't collect information and you don't mount operations in the United States. Now, did the CIA adhere to that? Not really. In more sophisticated ways, the CIA would plant articles in papers, let's say in West Germany at the time, or in France, or in India, and they would get published, and they'd get played back into the U.S. media, so there would be technical observance of the law, and the CIA operative saying, well, you know, once we place these things, which we can in India, that's okay, that's legal. They get back to the United States, you know, and we can't control that. So that was a little disingenuous, but at least it was a little more adherent to the letter of the law. But, you know, you have to look back at what CIA leaders have said. And if you look at what Bill Colby, now William Colby was director in the mid-70s, okay, and it was at this time when people revealed the heinous things that CIA operations people had been doing in the 60s and the 50s, okay, and he testified before Congress telling the truth and was ostracized by his colleagues in the intelligence community and fired by Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. Now, he became pretty outspoken, and the remark that I'm referring to now was what he said about controlling the media, and he said the CIA controls just about every important person in the media in the United States. Now, there's some dispute, I should say, as to exactly what words he used to say that, but me as a kind of a young, up-and-coming, I hoped, analyst, to say, well, you know, I know Bill, he's an honest guy, but I mean, everyone is given to a little hyperbole now and then. Almost everyone in them, come on, well, you know what? It wasn't far from that. And if you fast forward from the mid-70s to when Ronald Reagan came in 1981, his CIA director, a fellow named Bill Casey, said, and I quote, "When we had succeeded in deceiving the entire American people into things we want them to believe, we will know that we have achieved our mission," end quote. Now, is there some dispute about that? Not in my mind. I know a woman who was there when he said that. So, look at what the New York Times and the Washington Post has been dishing out for the last 2 months. The Russians are bad. The Russians gave the election to Trump. We can't talk to the Russians because they're the evil incarnate. So, it is the Post and the Times that are running this vicious campaign to make the incoming president illegitimate from the get-go. A lot of my friends, my very disappointed, disheartened Democratic friends who can't make their peace with the fact that the Trump campaign outsmarted the Clinton campaign and what they consider to be so many, quote, dumb Americans, end quote, voted for Trump, you know. I mean, they, as I say before, they have PTSD. And so they willingly believe this stuff and tell all their friends, yeah, well, it's in the New York Times, it's in the Washington Post. So bottom line here on the media, Bill Casey and Bill Colby have shown me that it was, yeah, maybe just a little bit hyperbole, but mostly fact in terms of the way the New York Times, especially, and the Washington Post equally, are influenced by CIA in a way that really prevents us from having any insight into what's really going on.
So, Ray McGovern, you keep harping back to the election and Trump's campaigns in focusing on the Electoral College, which is definitely true and indisputable. Some people think that this is presenting a constitutional crisis in our country. I forget, the third time in 20 years that the person who got the majority of the popular vote was not elected president. Now, this is a discussion that's really for another time, but I think in fairness, it's okay to remind ourselves that Hillary Clinton got just shy of 3 million more votes than Trump did. So I'm personally not surprised that people are frustrated that he is the president. But as you said, that is the way our Constitution is set up. I do think it's a little ironic, though, that one of the reasons it's set up that way is to preserve the republic from mob rule. Anyway, if you want to very briefly comment on that, please do, but don't, okay?
Yeah, well, you know, if this were a surprise to anyone, if it were a surprise to the Hillary campaign that she had to win Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the other states out there, Ohio, then that would be one thing. But this is those are the ground rules. That's the way the game is played. As you pointed out, Hillary's not the only person who lost having won the popular vote. So I hold no brief for the Electoral College. I think it may have played a useful role at one point in time. But I think it's antiquated and should be readdressed, the whole setup. But, you know, if you look at all the other propaganda reasons why Trump is illegitimate, all of them contrived, then you have to put this one in that same category. Yeah, he didn't get, well, Hillary got almost 3 million more votes than he did. Are Hillary supporters disappointed? Of course they are. Is it sort of an anomaly that that this should happen? No. Happened before? Will happen again unless we change the rules. So you don't change the rules midstream unless you have PTSD and you're looking for all kinds of reasons to make Trump illegitimate. And, you know, I'll say again, John Lewis is a hero of mine. What he went through there in the civil rights movement, he's just an icon, okay? But he has no business, in my view, saying that he considers the duly elected president of the United States illegitimate. I don't see how that squares with his oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. The rules have been observed. Nobody likes the result. Very few people like the result, especially those that are still living in shock. But, you know, it used to be that we just played by the rules, and we shook our heads and said, well, maybe you ought to change the rules, but not in midstream.
Okay, well, let's thank you for those comments. So given that in 2 days, Trump is scheduled to become the 45th, I think it is, president of the United States, many people are speculating that this will completely reset relationships, not only with Russia, but also with the intelligence community. He's made no secret of his disdain for the security community. And that community has been vastly expanded since 9/11. It's not just the CIA anymore. It's a whole mega industry involving not just government, but the private sector as well. Can you talk about this expansion and how it bodes for our democracy?
Well, we have an expression in this country, and I imagine your listeners will be able to complete the sentence. I'll start it out. After 9/11, everything, you got it, changed. Now, what does that mean in the terms of your question? Well, it means that the CIA has, most people say, three times as much money to throw around. That the rest of the community has all manner of money to hire contractors and to do all manner of other things like Stuxnet. And so the power of the what they call the dark state or the deep state, the intelligence and security services has increased immeasurably. We know that the National Security Agency monitors all. It boggles the mind, doesn't it? It monitors all our emails and telephone conversations. When I say monitor, that's not, we don't have millions of people listening in on them real time. No, they're intercepted and they're stored. And these mammoth storage facilities that have been built show just the extent of all this storage when you think of what you can get onto one little thumb drive. So the intelligence community has increased in strength and in numbers and especially in money and in influence. Now, when I say influence, I think it's very, very clear that Obama has been led by the nose by people like John Brennan. You know, Obama's sort of a wishy-washy guy. He, you know, John Brennan says, well, we really ought to support these, quote, moderate, end quote, rebels in Syria. And Obama says, oh, there are moderate rebels there? And John Brennan says, yeah, and besides, we got $2 billion to spend on this, and we'd like to, you know, get rid of Assad. And so Obama, not having anywhere else to go, and having very little experience in this realm, asks Hillary Clinton, you think it's a good idea? She says, oh, yeah, yeah, sure. And so the crocodile tears that John Brennan is now shedding for all the chaos and killing that has happened under his watch in Syria, you know, are something to behold. What I'm saying here is that Obama didn't have the experience or the people or, frankly, the guts to rein in these security services. And so you end up with a tripling of the number of soldiers we had in Afghanistan right after Obama came in. And we had the proxy wars in Syria. Every now and then there would be kind of like a ray of truth come through. And after Obama had let himself be sucked into these things, he would say, as he did 3 years ago, in an interview with Tom Friedman of the New York Times, which was televised, Friedman said, "Well, tell us about these young professionals and these people who were guided the right way, and these moderates in Syria." And Obama, most people don't know this, he kind of laughed. He said, "Oh, come on," he says, "The notion that there are moderates in Syria is a fantasy." Oh, well, say, that was his word, okay? Obama. Fantasy. Oh, that was 3 years ago. All of a sudden, last year, these fantasy rebels, these moderates, so-called, like Lazarus, they came out of the tomb and they became a potent force. And Brennan's pouring all kinds of money, and so is our military, into supporting these, quote, moderate rebels who are, in fact, cooperating with al-Qaeda in Syria. It goes by a different name there. It's called al-Nusra. But untold killing and chaos has happened in Syria because of people like John Brennan and people who Obama didn't know enough to say, well, maybe that's not such a good idea. That's what you get when you let people like Brennan, like Hillary Clinton, like Bobby Gates and others come in, and the generals, of course, Petraeus and the others, run your policy. So what I'm saying here is that Obama can be faulted for being a combination of naive and arrogant. When he came into Washington 8 years ago, he thought he could be Abraham Lincoln. He had read this book, Team of Rivals, by Doris Kearns Goodwin. And as you know, Lincoln had staffed his top advisors with people, some of whom didn't agree with him. Now, Obama didn't know who to agree with. He was, didn't know much about foreign policy. And so he let Bobby Gates stay on as defense secretary. He picked Hillary Clinton, of all people, to be the secretary of state. And he had a whole bunch of people that he kind of inherited or said, oh, these people, yeah. And so he was encumbered right from the start by not having any experience and then by picking the wrong people. So,
Ray, I am so sorry. Yeah, go ahead. We are actually beyond our time limit here. We could easily go on for another 2, 3, 4 hours. Thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio, and I hope we can call on you again.
Most welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Our guest today has been Ray McGovern, a CIA veteran of 27 years. He is, among many other things, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals Sanity. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson. I'm Joy LaClaire. You can contact us by emailing forthrightradio@gmail.com. And it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway. The views expressed on today's show are those of the speaker only and do not reflect those of KZYX staff, board of directors, or management.